Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hello, welcome once again to Visegrad Insights podcast. My name is Galen Dahl, and I am joined here today with Adam Yasser.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And today in the news covering the region, we have the very long delayed EU aid package for Ukraine, totally about $50 billion. After finally the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban kind of bowed under pressure and removed his veto. And now Adam wrote a very nice commentary last week, just as it kind of occurred. And Adam, break us down. How did things unfold so we get to this point?
Well, it's still a bit of a mystery what actually happened and why Mr. Orban suddenly caved in without actually achieving much in return. Just a reminder, he's been blocking this package, a four-year package of financial aid to Ukraine for several months now. And in December at the summit, which was supposed to approve it, he vetoed it. So, you know, he caved in the end. It seems that finally key capitals in the European Union, namely Germany and France, were finally ready to really roll out big guns and deprive Hungary not only of money, but also possibly starting a procedure, a special procedure provided for by the European treaties to actually strip Hungary of its voting rights. And of course, Mr. Orban's position has already weakened considerably inside the EU once the government changes in Poland. Before Poland's Law and Justice Party and Orban's Fidesz were holding each other's back, so to speak, in all the disputes with EU partners, even though they differed on their views on Ukraine. That needs to be said. Poland never took Orban's line about Ukraine not being sovereign or Ukraine not belonging to Europe and so on and so forth. So, but for tactical reasons, these two, and ideological reasons, these two governments supported each other. And with Poland now under a new government and with Mr. Tusk, the new Polish Prime Minister, very clearly articulating that for Orban the choice was to remain in Europe or to be out of Europe, and with the Slovak Prime Minister playing his usual opportunistic game of talking big but then doing what's right for his country, it became clear that he wasn't going to die for Viktor Orban. And that probably persuaded Orban to cave in. The really surprising thing is that at the end of the day, despite his reputation for being such a great strategist and cunning negotiator, he got absolutely nothing. No money, no veto. So that's a first. I think there was an element which sort of unnerved him as well, which was that, you know, Hungary caught flat-footed over Sweden's NATO membership, because Orban promised the Swedes and partners in Europe and the Americans that Hungary would not be the last country to approve Sweden's NATO membership. And then suddenly Turkey came out and approved it. And Hungary became the last country in NATO to not to have approved Sweden's NATO bid. And the stubbornness over this is so incomprehensible on both sides of the Atlantic that there's real sort of sense that people had enough. They've had enough with Orban. And I think that sort of also persuaded him to lay low for a while, if you will.
No, yeah, I like that. Donald Tusk did say the people have been reflecting upon some of us having Ukraine fatigue, which is a horrible kind of concept even his own. But he countered with, I believe everyone has Orban fatigue, which I agree is kind of a nice sum up of how he's kind of utilized his position and kind of manipulated the Brussels for far too long. Well, staying with security for a moment, I'd like to turn to the V4 in Poland. And kind of see that there's kind of some good news that it seems that Poland has finally secured funding for some of its arm purchases from South Korea. my question to you, Adam, is how important do you think this deal is, not just for Polish, but also European security in general?
I'll make a caveat that I'm not an arms expert. So I making this declaration, of course, frees me to speculate a little bit more freely. No, but seriously speaking, you know, yes, it seems Korea will unlock the second tranche of financing because it's a deal where Korea exports arms, but at the same time, it provides a loan facility, which then Poland repays. For Poland, this is a useful vehicle because it enables financing of these purchases, of these emergency purchases, if you will, outside of the budget. It increases Poland's overall debt, and so it needs to be repaid. So obviously, it has fiscal implications, but it doesn't expand the budget deficit per se, which also makes it easier for Poland to meet EU criteria on deficit limits. So also the financing, that the price that you get on such loans is lower than what you would normally get in the market on Polish bonds. So there are many reasons why for Poland this is convenient. For Korea, obviously, this is a way of subsidizing or supporting their exports. So everybody's happy. And, you know, there has been a lot of discussion about whether it makes sense for Poland to make these purchases in South Korea rather than to buy European or American equipment, which is compatible with NATO. Well, to this, some experts are saying, well, it doesn't matter. In a situation like this, when you need to scale up quickly, and beef up your defenses, you should buy whatever equipment you can get your hands on. So, for example, you know, very few people are disputing the sense of buying the K2 main battle tanks, 1,000 of which Poland is ordering. The same goes for rocket launchers and so on and so forth. The only purchase in that package which sort of is a bit doubtful, and some experts have been expressing reservations, is the purchase of fighter training jets, which certainly wouldn't make a huge difference on the battlefield, it seems. But again, you know, that's available. Korea can deliver that stuff relatively quickly. That said, you know, the Polish Defense Ministry under the new leadership is doing an audit of all these deals. And of course, the next step is to see how Poland intends to play within the European arms industry and coordination on defense. We know that the EU is preparing a huge fund to spend on armaments, on boosting industrial capacity in this sector. And, you know, it would be a shame if Poland did not participate. The previous government was very lukewarm on this. They didn't want to participate in different European schemes. So it's something that really, you know, people who are experts in this field need to analyze in a cool way without sort of political and ideological aspects driving the agenda. It should be pure calculation of risk, of opportunity, and ultimately of capabilities.
Yeah, this is a sentiment that's been echoed by, of course, we want it would be strategically advantageous if we could have all these armaments built and produced on European soil. But the fact of the matter is, currently capabilities are not there yet, and we're still have to kind of be ramping them up, which is interesting because there's a story that came out of Czech Republic where they have found, I think it was like 400 some million rounds of ammunition, that they kind of want the EU's permission to kind of procure them because they are outside of the EU. So we're going to be following that story because I think that's quite fascinating as it kind of develops. Staying in with security, but kind of in a different light. There was a fascinating story that came out last week from Latvia. Now, I'm going to have to give a shout out to the journalists who did kind of extensive work on this. They were from a collaboration from The Insider. There's a news site, Delphi Estonia, Latvia's Ria Baltica Investigative Journalist Center, and even Sweden's Expressen newspaper all came together and broke a story that there is a long-standing Latvian MEP who has been a Russian collaborator for decades. It's one of those bizarre stories that it's kind of hard to even kind of wrap your mind around. Adam, would you kind of walk us through that one a little bit, and then we can?
No, we don't have that much time. So yes, this was discovered, but I would like to draw our listeners' attention to the fact that I'm surprised that we're surprised. In a sense, this is part of a pattern of Russian foreign influence operations across Europe and across the West, aiming to divide, to introduce political narratives that are friendly towards Moscow's attitudes. And, you know, this coincides with new reports of an old story that, for example, there was Russian money involved in the Catalonian bid for independence a few years back in Spain. Right, there are Russian footprints in the Brexit referendum. There was meddling in the U.S. election. There was meddling in the French election. I think some of the stuff happening in Poland, in Slovakia, in Hungary, we see that these Russian narratives and actually clandestine operations are taking place. And remember that in the East Bloc, particularly the Baltic countries, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, you know, Russian influence is rooted in the communist times. So you can't exclude that a number of sort of opinion makers or even some politicians may still be one way or the other agents of influence. Okay, you know, I don't want to sound paranoid and conspiratorial, but, you know, things like the Latvian MEP who for several years acted as a Russian agent of influence should be a cautionary tale. The good thing is that, of course, as people grow aware of this, in Germany, they recently discovered that there was a huge misinformation campaign involving a huge Russian influence operation. So, you know, the good thing is, of course, that after Russia's attack on Ukraine, some of this stuff has gained prominence in the public discourse, and people are aware that there is this risk. So there is growing, resistance to this, and also European citizens are aware that they may be sometimes objects of Russian efforts at manipulation. So this is good, but you have to be vigilant there.
Absolutely. And I'd have to say that this always makes me kind of revisit the pro-Russian, or let's say just kind of echoing of Russian and Kremlin's narratives that you hear from, unfortunately, many members in the GOP in the US. The question being, are they just kind of echoing these kind of theories that kind of are they're being fed, which is what I believe it is. But in that case, you have to kind of wonder, that would be like the most useful.
No, I wouldn't go that far. Some of these things move in parallel and they feed into one another. But I think the dominant trend in America is isolationism and opportunism of the GOP, who wants just to portray anything Biden does as bad policy, which doesn't mean that they cannot reverse that once they're in power. So in America, it's slightly different. But in Europe, you have to be very clear about what the Russian objectives have been for ages, effectively. Divide Europe, play Germany, France against each other, and possibly Eastern Europeans against Western Europeans. So divide and rule, and to push Americans out. So in that sense, you're right that some of these GOP narratives are in line with the Russian narratives, because at the end of the day, this is the main Russian objective, to get the Americans out of Europe, because they realize that then Europe will be weaker and it will be easier for Russian interests to be represented versus Germany and France. Of course, the attack on Ukraine changed that dynamic a little bit, because no one in Europe these days, or at least the majority of the political actors in Europe, are not really prepared to play Putin's game. So on that front, he certainly suffered a setback. But I don't think this long-standing approach of Russia to Europe is going to change. This is a long-term project of trying to subjugate Europe one way or the other.
Thank you very much, Adam. All right, that's all we have time today. So thank you for joining, and talk to you next week.
Thank you. See you next week.